Hello, this is Nancy Pippin with the Pantograph for Wednesday, November the 8th, 2017. And we will start this morning, or this reading, with the news of a birth center celebrating a year of making families. It says, facility on track as women seek services in less clinical setting. A poignant thing happened as Downstate Illinois' first licensed freestanding birthing center reached its goal for its first year. A family was created. I feel like they, patient families, are part of my family, said Amy Hernandez, certified nurse midwife and director of midwifery at the birth center of Bloomington Normal, 6 Westport Court, Bloomington. I like being a part of their lives. Hernandez spoke at the birth center on Tuesday shortly before the 80th birth happened at the center since its first delivery on October 26, 2016. Considering all the services at the birth center, which began providing prenatal care in July of 2016, more than 200 patients have been served, said office coordinator Jessica Pope. Our numbers are pretty much on track with what we expected, Pope said. Danielle Giles, whose daughter Arwen was the first baby born at the birth center on October 26, 2016, said the numbers prove Central Illinois women wanted natural childbirth. They are professional and they treat you like family, said Giles, who lived in Champaign when Arwen was born, but now lives in Indiana. Giles keeps in contact with Hernandez and her husband, and she, her husband, and Arwen were among 70 people who were recently packed the birth center for a first birthday party. The birth center received its state license for deliveries in October 2016, 2 years after the state's first center opened in Berwyn. They remain the state's only two licensed freestanding birth centers. The goal of Dr. Joe Santiago and Dr. Dale Ogunley, Bloomington Normal obstetrician gynecologist, who are co-owners of the birth center, is to attract Central Illinois women who want to give birth in a less clinical, less costly setting. Birthing centers are for women at low risk of birthing complications, and when complications arrive, the center has an arrangement with nearby OSF Healthcare St. Joseph Medical Center to accept the patient. Of the 80 labor and delivery patients so far, 10 have required transfer and none had adverse outcomes. Pope said that 12% transfer rate is consistent with licensed birth centers nationwide. Most of the 10 patients were in labor transfer, largely for women whose water had erupted but they needed medicine to induce labor, and for women experiencing long labor who decided they wanted an epidural for pain relief. 4 women needed cesarean sections, but of that, 5% C-section rate is lower than the national average of 32%. Pope said. Renelle Composta, manager of patient care for St. Joseph Birthing Center, which had 723 births in the fiscal year ending September 30th, said outcomes for patients who we have received from the birth center have been outstanding. I think the birth center has served women with low-risk pregnancies well, Composto said. It gives them an option. We continue to be supportive of the birth center and the niche it provides for low-risk women who wish to give birth outside of a hospital setting, said Lori Harper, director of nursing practice and obstetrics for Advocate Bromine Medical Center in Normal, where 1,611 babies were born during 2016. The state of Illinois was ready for this, Santiago said of the birth center. Pope noted that two-thirds of patients have been from outside Bloomington Normal, some from 90 minutes away. Other services at the birth center include well woman gynecological care, prenatal visits, prenatal yoga, childbirth education classes, newborn exams, postpartum care, and car seat safety checks. The center employs 3 certified nurse midwives and 2 office coordinators. We believe in the birth center and what they're providing families, Giles said. We are proud to be a part of their history. It feels like family, Santiago said. I wasn't prepared for that. I have been re-inspired. It's been an honor and a joy to support women to take ownership of their birth experience and to observe the empowerment that results, said certified nurse wife Angie Detweiler. Anything that increases health care options for women is a positive thing for the community. Our next article is out of DeWitt County. Gun club permit to go back to board. This is DeWitt County. Decision may come next week. Out of Clinton, the special use permit for a proposed DeWitt County Gun Club could come before the DeWitt County Board next week in what may be a showdown between club members and neighbors opposed to the plan. The conflict between the Leroy Rifle and Pistol Club and neighbors who don't want a gun range has focused on a legal fight over an easement between the club and Don Funderburg, who owns the land that leads to the club's landlocked property. County officials are delaying action on the permit. Club officials told the DeWitt County Zoning Board of Appeals on Monday that they have purchased additional land near the property that will allow access without that easement. The club members will now have access from the road, and issue of access has been mooted, and the issue of access has been mooted by the purchase, said Amy Rupiper, an attorney for the club. Despite the purchase, the ZBA voted 4-1 Monday against recommending the permit to the county board because the legal dispute on the easement still is pending. The county board instructed us to resolve the issue, the access issue, ZBA board member Dave Waters said. The fact that this is still under litigation tells me that the issue is not solved. Funderburg's attorney, Joe Taylor, said his client will continue to fight the proposed club regardless of what happens on the access issue. These 40 acres should never have been purchased for this, he said. Anyone with any common sense would have taken an option on this and checked these things out. There are 4 $250,000 homes within 200 to 300 yards of this property, Taylor said. The zoning law said you cannot have a gun club within a mile of a home. What they are not telling you is that they don't qualify. The county board has not addressed the issue of the club's proximity to homes, focusing instead on the access issue. The club, which has a lease on land near Leroy that is about to expire, bought the land northwest of Wapapella in 2016 and announced plans to convert the property into a gun range and meeting place for members. Club members presented their request for the special use permit to the DeWitt County Board in August of 2016, but the board delayed a decision because of access concerns. It sent the matter back to the ZBA with instructions for the ZBA to address the access and easement issues. Funderburg, that's the lawyer, that's the homeowner, had granted access to previous owners but denied it to the club, which then sued Funderburg. DeWitt County Judge Gary Weber ruled the club was entitled to an easement, but only for personal or agricultural use, and not for business use. The gun club appealed, and the case still is pending. Rue Piper argued to the ZBA Monday that the club's new land purchase means the easement dispute that blocked ZBA approval was no longer a concern. But the ZBA chairman, Andy Hedrick, said the purchase is not a matter for the ZBA to consider. The matter is likely to go to the county board on November 16th, and about 25 people attended the ZBA meeting, including several members of the club. So that'll be interesting to see how that works out in the future. Next, we have an article about the Illinois legislature. Illinois lawmakers take on harassment mess. Legislation to require training, expand role of inspector general. This is from Springfield. Illinois lawmakers spent most of Tuesday trying to get control of an avoidable sexual harassment mess, which began with a seemingly benign, if sincere, proposal last month to explicitly forbid harassment and intimidation in the ethics code. Both the House and Senate unanimously adopted the legislation that started the melee. House Speaker Michael Madigan's proposal to require sexual harassment awareness training for all state officers, lawmakers, staff members, and lobbyists, and leave enforcement violations to the inspectors general for each. The apparently straightforward, universally supported idea created side effects that engulfed the General Assembly for weeks in a state still suffering the impact of a historic 2-year state budget stalemate and a $16.6 billion in past due bills. It required additional legislation, also okayed unanimously, to expand powers for the newly appointed legislative inspector general to investigate more than 24 complaints that piled up during the 2-year vacancy in the post. The impact of inaction became painfully clear last week when legislative activist Denise Rothmer accused State Senator Ira Silverstein of Chicago Democrat of sexual harassment last year while the two worked on legislation. Silverstein has denied the allegation. He appeared on the floor Senate waving to reporters as he passed the press box and speaking for several minutes with Senate President John Cullerton for several minutes before taking his seat and working on a laptop. No one approached or spoke to him. Later, as he left the floor, he told reporters, "My first conversation will be with the Inspector General. Thank you." Chicago Democrat Madigan's legislation proscribing harassment appeared days after an open letter signed by 300 people swept through the State House demanding an end to a long-established culture of harassment and intimidation in the Capitol. The letter followed on the heels of sexual harassment scandals rolling the nation this fall, beginning with allegations against Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein and other powerful men through the revival of the hashtag MeToo social media campaign among victims. It's time for us to find a way to call a halt to sexual harassment in and around the Capitol and allow the sun to shine instead of shadows to prevail when people misbehave, said House Majority Leader Barbara Flynn Curry, a Chicago Democrat. But Madigan's plan revealed the vacancy, and when Rothmeyer, testifying last week in favor of it, publicized alleged incidents in which Silverstein, working with her last year on legislation, sent her inappropriate messages and paid her unwanted compliments. She asked why nothing had happened in the complaint she filed in November of 2016. Senate President Cullerton's office acknowledged the complaint was referred to the Inspector General's office, where it sat idle after the last full-time inspector retired in 2014. That forced Cullerton, a Chicago Democrat, to accept Silverstein's resignation from his leadership post and a $21,000 annual stipend. And the Legislative Ethics Commission, after years of saying it couldn't find a suitable candidate for the job, met in an emergency session Saturday and appointed former federal prosecutor Julia Porter. Our final article on the front page is one from the National News. It regards the shooting in Sutherland Springs. It's entitled, Shooter Once Fled Mental Health Center. Sutherland Springs, Texas. The gunman who carried out the massacre of 26 people at a small town Texas church briefly escaped from a mental health center in New Mexico in 2012 and got into trouble for bringing guns onto a military base and threatening his superiors there, police reports indicate. Devin Patrick Kelly was also named as a suspect in a 2013 sexual assault in his hometown of New Braunfels, about 35 miles from the scene of the church attack. The records that emerged Tuesday added up to at least three missed opportunities that might have offered law enforcement a way to stop Kelly from having access to guns long before he slaughtered much of the congregation in the middle of a Sunday service. Kelly died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound after he was chased by bystanders and crashed his car. The Air Force confirmed Tuesday that Kelly had been treated in the facility after he was placed under pretrial confinement stemming from a court-martial on charges that he assaulted his spouse and hit her child hard enough to fracture the boy's skull. Involuntary commitment to a mental institution would have been grounds to deny him a weapon, provided the records of his confinement were submitted to the federal database used to conduct background checks on people who try to purchase guns. Kelly was also caught trying to bring guns into Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico when he was stationed there, according to an El Paso, Texas police report released Tuesday. While in the military, Kelly, who was 21 at the time, had made death threats against superior officers, according to the June 2012 report, which also mentioned the military charges. He was eventually sentenced to 12 months of confinement for that assault. The Air Force acknowledged Monday that it did not enter Kelly's criminal history into the federal database as required by military rules. Had Kelly been convicted of sexual assault, he would likely have been prevented from purchasing a gun because federal guidelines prohibit sales to anyone convicted of a felony punishable by more than a year in prison. Comal County Sheriff said he was reviewing whether the department mishandled the sexual assault investigation. Officers recovered a Ruger AR-556 rifle at the church and two additional handguns from the shooter's vehicle, said Fred Milanowski, the agent in charge of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives in Houston. All three weapons were purchased by Kelly, Milanowski said. The sporting goods chain Academy Sports and Outdoors confirmed Monday that it sold Kelly two guns. The El Paso report notes that Kelly was committed to a mental health facility in Santa Teresa, New Mexico, but at some point escaped and was later found by police at a bus station in downtown El Paso in June of 2012. In New Braunfels, Comal County, Sheriff Mark Reynolds said that it appeared sheriff's deputies investigated the rape case for 3 months after being called to Kelly's home in June of 2013, but stopped investigation after they believed Kelly had left Texas and moved to Colorado. Reynolds said the case was then listed as inactive. Reynolds said he was trying to find out how deputies came to believe Kelly had moved and why they did not continue to pursue the case either in Colorado or after Kelly returned to the area later. Deputies were called to the same house in February of 2014 to investigate a domestic violence report involving Kelly and Danielle Shields, his girlfriend at the time, who he married 2 months later. The last information that we have is the suspect moved to Colorado and then the investigation seems to have tapered off. That's what we're looking into. The district attorney for Comal County said in an interview that she became aware of the sexual assault case Monday before the records were released to the Associated Press and other media. That case was never presented to our office, Jennifer Tharp said. We now move on to page A3 for local news, beginning with Normal withholds grants. City Council denies funding for revamped Finney Oil Building. An uptown landowner will need to keep working if he wants to receive $15,000 in promised town grant funding for a redevelopment project. Normal City Council voted 4-3 Monday to deny that money to Chuck Finney for work at 208 Parkinson Street, which he's overhauled over the last 18 months, thanks in part to $25,000 in already paid grant funding, because the finished project ended up very different from what the town was promised. The town staff gave Feeney that message previously, and he proposed additional improvements he can make in exchange for getting the additional money, but the council members said they aren't enough. The former Feeney Oil Building, which sat vacant for a decade, is now a Stout chiropractic office. Mayor Chris Coos, Kathleen Lorenz, and Kevin McCarthy and Scott Peterson voted against paying the grant money. Kimberly Cummings, Jeff Fritzen, and R.C. McBride voted to release it. The biggest change from plans Feeney showed the town in 2016 was the omission of a stair-step style plaza in front of the building that proved impossible due to drainage requirements. The detention basin is now where the plaza was planned to be, and Feeney has proposed adding landscaping around it. It seems to me that the project's scope has changed fundamentally, and our grant should change subsequently to match that scope, said McCarthy. I understand that change was through no specific fault of the owner. Still, the scope was broadly different, and I'm disinclined to support this. Another change is installation of a small canopy directly upon the west side of the building rather than the planned wider one in the plaza. Feeney proposed adding wall hangings on that side of the building to cover the difference and adding more fabric to the canopy, which is now partially exposed metal. The town pledged to contribute $40,000. We might not have gotten what we thought we were getting, said McBride, but given the staff seems satisfied with the changes are good enough. Therefore, I don't think there's a good enough reason to not follow through on what we pledged to do. After the meeting, Peterson said he expects Feeney to contact the town about how to proceed. Feeney did not respond to the request for comment on Tuesday. What we recommend If a property owner funds himself or herself in this situation, before they start, they come and ask for a modification, said Peterson. Ordinarily, the property owner would have said, "Time out, I'm not going to be able to do what I planned." They chose to proceed. Finney planned to spend $300,000 on the upgrade, he said, in 2016, and after the site was finished, he'll look to redevelop properties behind it near the intersection of Parkinson and Oak Streets that he owns as well. Jeffrey Stout's former office at 214 Linden Street is now vacant. Our next article regards longtime Chestnut CEO Hagen to retire. Russ Hagen, who was a seminarian working at a church on Bloomington's west side when he became acquainted with Lighthouse, the not-for-profit drug program, has helped him. The not-for-profit drug treatment program, as he helped a congregate addicted to amphetamines. When he graduated from seminary, the head of Lighthouse asked Hagen if he was interested in working for the organization. "I thought it would be an appropriate ministry," Hagen told the Pantograph Tuesday. "It was 1974. It's been everything I hoped it would be and so much more." Hagen, 68, of Bloomington, announced Tuesday he was retiring effective January 7th from the organization, which became Chestnut Health Center Health Systems after 43 years, including the past 36 as CEO. When he joined Lighthouse, the drug treatment program had 24 employees and a budget of $300,000. Today, Chestnut is a diversified health care organization with a $50 million annual budget and 700 employees across Illinois and beyond. Hagen will continue to work part-time over the next 2 years, supporting Chestnut's Global Employee Assistance Program. Chestnut's Board of Directors will meet later this month to discuss succession plans. Russ has been a pioneer with behavioral health and addiction recovery services, both in our community and internationally for many years, said Colleen Canaday, president of Advocate Bromine Medical Center in Normal. His visionary leadership at Chestnut has benefited many through the growth and expansion of services. Russ Hagen is one of the most quietly impactful men in healthcare that I have known, said Dr. Paul Patterson, Vice President of Medical Affairs at OSF Healthcare St. Joseph Medical Center in Bloomington. Chestnut, based at 1003 Martin Luther King Drive, Bloomington, is experiencing its second executive change in recent months. In June, Chief Operating Officer Alan Sender, 63, announced his retirement effective July 7th. After 29 years with Chestnut, he remains a part-time consultant. But Sender and Hagen said both retirements had been in the works for several years and the timing had been coordinated. In the last 2 years, they have been training and mentoring young leadership who have been assuming more responsibility, Hagen said. I am confident in the stability of the organization in the future. Chestnut has 256 employees in Bloomington Normal, 417 in the Metro East area, and 37 at other locations. Chestnut's line of business are substance abuse treatment and adults and adolescents, mental health treatment, substance abuse research, and training employee assistance programs for U.S.-based and multinational companies. Mental health stabilization, substance use detoxification, consumer credit counseling, and primary health care through federal qualified health centers on Chestnut Street in Bloomington and Granite City. Chestnut has grown primarily because they always stayed in touch with the community we serve, Hagen said. As Chestnut helped to identify community needs, such as substance abuse employee assistance programs, the organization sought partners to respond. Russ Hagen, Sender said, is the essence of cooperation. And that point being said, we will take a short break and return for the second half of the paper, the Pantograph for Wednesday, November the 8th, 2017.